I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection. There is balm in Gilead, the old spiritual says, to make the wounded whole. It's a song being sung with special fervor this week in some black churches around the country. This is the week of prayer for the healing of AIDS, the epidemic that struck the African-American community far out of proportion to other groups. African-Americans make up 13% of the U.S. population, but according to the Centers for Disease Control, blacks represent half of reported AIDS cases, and AIDS remains the leading cause of death for African-Americans between 25 and 44. But for all the horror, there is still denial and dismissal of the AIDS epidemic in some black communities. Suspicion that it's a white man's disease, a plague of someone else's making, a government plot. There's cause for skepticism. For example, the Tuskegee experiment, where from the 30s to the 70s, scientists in Alabama watched but didn't treat poor blacks with syphilis. And now, says the CDC, more and more young gay black men who grew up in the age of AIDS education seem to be ignoring it and having unprotected sex. Today, we tackle a topic that touches a lot of nerves. Connection listeners, why is the AIDS epidemic bringing such devastation to the black community? 1-800-423-8255 makes the African Americans and AIDS connection. Joining us in the studio from the AIDS Action Coalition are Gary Daffin, who heads the Multicultural AIDS Coalition. Welcome, Gary. And Belinda Dunn, who directs the Who Touched Me ministry in Boston. And I should make it clear here that clearly by your presence, not everybody in the black community is ignoring these infection rates, which are astounding. Can we start out by just telling me, Belinda, first, how this spike in AIDS infection rates has affected your work? What are you doing here in Boston?
I've been working at the AIDS Action Committee for the last 10 years, and my job was to produce programs for the African-American community to make them aware, first, that the disease exists and that they are at risk. And one of those programs that became close to me and dear to me was the Week of Prayer for the Healing of AIDS. We founded Who Touched Me Ministry in 1993, and it was after going to a conference for the Balm in Gilead in New York City and saw how they were responding to the AIDS epidemic through the black church, and that was unheard of in Boston. So I call myself being a pioneer in Boston, and it was not an easy job. But to come back and talk with the ministers here and find out where they were. And, of course, I ran into the same denial that you just spoke of.
I wonder about that. I mean, tell me a little bit about what you did run into. Give me some examples of what people
basically
said to you.
Basically, doors slammed in my face. Ministers telling me that AIDS was a punishment from God. And if those folks hadn't been practicing those behaviors, those homosexuals, those addicts, those prostitutes, these things wouldn't be happening to them. To the point that if they found someone in the church that had AIDS, I mean, they were treated so badly that they just left and never came back.
This is a very personal issue with you, right?
Oh, it's a very personal issue for me because I am a person that's living with HIV and went to my minister when I tested positive. The very first person I went to was my minister, and I was greeted with loving, compassionate care. And I just assumed that other churches were like that, but I found out differently.
I don't mean to be irreverent here, but it's clearly going to take a lot more than prayers. To turn things around.
Absolutely. I think that when we first started talking with the ministers, we started talking about the real issue, and that was homosexuality and why they were turning away from the AIDS epidemic, why they weren't responding. And we had to change it around because I realized that they needed to be educated. They knew nothing of the disease. They didn't know how it was contracted. They didn't know what circumstances that people may are being psychosocial issues in the community that may put them at risk for the disease. So we backed up a bit and slowly began to do what I call a backdoor approach. Mm-hmm. We started having events that would bring the community and their congregations in and let the congregations be the one to go and convince their minister that it's time for prevention education.
So things are changing.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Gary Daffin, let's bring you into the conversation here. You head up the Multicultural polysyllabic word AIDS Coalition in Boston. Tell us about your work and what kinds of responses you're running into.
Well, the Multicultural AIDS Coalition was started back in 1988 with support from the local state and city public health departments to really try and begin to mobilize the African-American and Latino communities here, because we were even back then, in fact, since the beginning of the epidemic, people of color have been affected. And the Multicultural AIDS Coalition started out doing work with different providers, doing cultural sensitivity training with them to make them more open to working with people of color, and also doing direct prevention and education within the community. We have been around for the past 12 years, and more recently, in the past 3 or 4 years, we've started to a really strong mobilization effort within the African American community, and also more recently linking with the Latino community as well. And what we're finding today is that people are now ready to really step up to the plate and start to work on HIV and AIDS issues in the community. We have regular meetings of what's called the Black HIV AIDS Coalition, and we've gotten most of the community health centers, most of the programs that are doing HIV and AIDS work in the community, and just regular community folks who come out and are helping to sort of create a plan for how do we really address this issue. And that's a very complex task.
What explains the kind of resistance that was going on in the Black community? I'm sure it's still present out there. How do you explain that? I mean,
there are lots of reasons why the African community has responded the way it has. I think if you look back to the beginning of the epidemic in the gay and lesbian community, or really the gay male community, the epidemic affected everyone across class. Across race, but it was more the gay white community, where people began to see that it didn't matter how much money you had or what job you had, if you got infected, you got sick. And at the time, people thought it was a gay disease. And so there were two things that happened. One, I think among gay people of color, they also thought that it was a white gay disease. And so we felt, well, at least we don't have to worry about that, which, of course, looking back, makes absolutely no sense. And at the same time, the African-American community in general also thought, well, this is a white disease and a gay disease. So it's more removed from that community. But if you look at, now we look back and we see that there were infections among injection drug users in New York as far back as 1978 and 79. It wasn't called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency, because people weren't identifying it, because those injection drug users weren't really valued. No one really cared. They were dying. Well, who cares that they're dying? So there was a false impression from the very beginning that this was a gay disease and that it was a white disease. And that, I think, is sort of the fundamental starting point of why we took divergent tracks in different communities.
We'll come back to that. I want to bring in another discussant here. Before I do that, I'll give you the phone numbers. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. You can join us on The Connection. We're talking about AIDS in the African-American community. I want to go now to Dr. Helene Gale. She's online with us from New York. She directs the National Center for HIV, STD, and TB Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. Welcome to the Connection.
Hi, John.
Let me just give you a statement here before we start here. This is from the CDC, and it's, quote, Today, AIDS poses a fundamental threat to the future health, well-being, and human potential of many African-American communities. How do you back that up, Dr. Gale?
Well, there are a lot of ways to back it up. First of all, AIDS is still the leading cause of death for African-American men and women between the ages of 25 and 49. 1 in 50 African-American men are living with HIV. 1 in 160 African-American women are living with HIV. African-Americans are 9 times more likely to develop AIDS and to die with AIDS than their white counterparts. So clearly this is having a major impact and a disproportionate impact on the African-American community.
You must know something about the kinds of resources that flow into fighting AIDS in both the white community and the Black community. Are we seeing enough dollars flowing into the Black community to deal with this issue?
Well, yes and no. I think the resources that have been specifically targeted to communities of color have increased substantially over time. Do we have enough money? There's you know, there's never enough money. I think that money, though, is not the only answer. Clearly, there are a lot of ingredients that go into how do you have an impact on a problem as grave as this. First and foremost, and I think it's the point that the previous discussant was mentioning, you've got to get the community engaged. You've got to get the community saying, this is a problem for us, and we will put at the disposal of this problem all of our collective resources. And so it's not just an issue of how much money does the government pump in, but how much priority does the community place on it, how many of the community's resources are marshaled, and that's not just dollars, but that's also human resources, the ability to talk about this issue, put it on the agenda front and center. And so it's all of those different resources, if you will, human resources, political capital, financial resources that can make a difference ultimately in halting the spread of this infection in African-American communities.
Melinda, I wonder if you could respond to the issue of whether enough resources are flowing into the black community to deal with this. You're dealing with it firsthand here.
Yeah, so. Well, you know, I have to say I've been a one-man show for quite some time working with the Who Touched Me Ministry. And the problem for churches and community-based organizations in the community is that we still have this issue of separation of church and state. How does that money trickle, those dollars trickle down to the churches, and how can we use some innovative programs that we can join the community-based organizations and the churches? The people in the church have to work also. So to have a designated person inside of the church, you need money to get them motivated. There's 450 churches, black churches in Boston that I know alone that are open, the little storefront churches. These are the people that need to be reached, not just the people sitting in the pulpits or sitting in the congregation, but the people that can educate from within the community, the guttermost, if I can say. Those are the people at the highest risk. How do we tie those two together? We can't do it without money.
Did the black church...
Sure. Oh, sorry, I was just going to agree with Belinda there. I mean, I think, you know, one of the organizations that we have increasingly worked with are faith organizations, because I think for all the reasons that Belinda said, it is so critical that we get the faith communities, churches, and the outreach from churches involved in this effort. And that's an area that we have targeted. Our own resources to the African American communities have increased over tenfold since from 1988 to 1999. Is it enough? No, it's still, we still know that the resources are not all that they need to be, but I think strategically targeting groups like faith communities, community-based organizations, organizations that have credibility in the African-American community can make a difference.
Dr. Gale, we're going to take a little break here. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking about AIDS in the African-American community. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection at 11, a look back at the history of the...
This is The Connection. This is the Black Church's week of prayer for the healing of AIDS, and so we visited a service at the Roxbury Presbyterian Church here in Boston. In his sermon, Reverend Anthony Miller described the frustration he felt as a young seminarian in New York City back in the 1980s by the non-response of his own church to the AIDS epidemic just starting to spread around him.
I found myself raging against the church, mostly behind closed doors, as friends of mine and loved ones were infected with HIV and AIDS. HIV and AIDS was never mentioned, although we had already had an organist die of AIDS. HIV and AIDS was never mentioned, although the second organist that replaced him had to leave as HIV got a hold of his life. HIV and AIDS was never mentioned, although several members of the choir and several members of the congregation were in hospital or in home dying of AIDS or dealing with their infection of HIV. And as I railed against the church, one particular HIV patient, he explained to me, he understood my pain, but he said, let me explain to you something. If we're content to continue as a people of faith together, we have to begin to take one another where we are and begin to love each other where we are in our particular journeys of faith.
The Reverend Anthony Miller at the Roxbury Presbyterian Church here in Boston. We're talking this hour about AIDS in the African-American community. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to join our discussion with Belinda Dunn of the Who Touched Me Ministry in Boston and Gary Daffin of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition. Gary, I wanted to ask you just very briefly, we were talking about whether there are enough resources available from the government and charities to carry out the battle in the black community against AIDS. What's your experience with that?
Well, I have two responses to that. One is, I think we need to get a little bit away from putting all of the onus on the black churches, because the black church is the people, not just the ministers. Mm-hmm. And the people are from across the board. And those people are an enormous resource, and it's the people from all classes and all sort of backgrounds in the community that need to take up this disease, and not just the ministers. And that those are resources that are not yet at the table that need to be there. Secondly, on a national level, we owe a great debt to the Congressional Black Caucus, which a few years ago pushed President Clinton and their colleagues to pass a significant amount of money to target communities of color. And that has grown to be, you know, several hundred million dollars specifically targeted to efforts in communities of color. And most of the major cities around the country have been able to access some of those dollars. Certainly we have here in Massachusetts. But I don't think that, as Dr. Gale said, it's not just the money. It is really the mobilization of the community. Mm-hmm. It is not just about hiring people to do the work. This kind of work, again, in the gay community, it wasn't just the fact that there were dollars, but that there was a commitment across the board by the men, the women, people from, you know, whether you were a banker or a clerk, you were doing something about HIV, and that's what we've got to do in communities of color.
Just one question to you, Belinda. I'm curious. Does the black church in these cities have enough clout, enough credit with young black men to carry out the battle?
Wow. That's put it this way. I think that peer education and leadership works much, much better than, you know, dealing. I mean, as a black woman, an older black woman, I would not think that a teenager would listen to the message that I have, but we can educate those peers to educate other peers. I do believe that the ministers need to be trained. They have to know about this disease. They have to be able to bring out the message in the pulpit so that it will carry on. So I think it takes a combination of everyone within the church, outside of the church, in the community, through the politicians, through everyone that's concerned. I mean, it has to be, like Gary said, it's got to be community mobilization. It has to be worked that way. It's not going to work at all.
Let's bring another well-known voice into this discussion, the Reverend Al Sharpton. He's the president of the National Action Network in New York City. Welcome to The Connection, Reverend.
Thank you. Good morning.
I want to ask you, I know a couple of years ago you had a conference about AIDS, and at that conference, as I understand it, a lot of people were voicing a lot of suspicion about whether or not this was truly affecting the black community, if it wasn't a plot, that HIV really wasn't the cause of AIDS, a lot of broad skepticism and mythology about this. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think that there are always people that will raise questions, particularly in communities that have always historically faced problems and faced problems from people that engineered them our way. But I think that clearly we are facing a serious problem. And by going into conspiracy theories and not dealing with the problem and not dealing with them as the people you have on this morning, from the strongest institution in our community, and that is our church, is to really help to expand the problem and embellish the problem rather than solve it. I think we have a moral obligation to do what we must do in an emergency type of spirit to deal with this epidemic.
And yourself and your own organization, what are you doing?
Well, we are on several levels. One, we're fighting for increased funding, though we don't want any, but clearly there needs to be increased funding for those research programs and other programs that deal with this problem. But we're more than anything, we're directly dealing with an awareness level. We work with Balm of Gilead and others and support them because clearly our churches need to be energized to really deal with the dissemination of the proper information and to really take away some of the bias. When this problem first went national, people were dealing with it from a homophobic point of view. Then from a point of view, this is just drug users. And I think that clearing away a lot of the misconceptions and dealing with a lot of the biases are very important.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking right now with Reverend Al Sharpton. Lewis is on the line. Lewis, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you, John. I had a couple of questions. I'd first like to say, though, I do get a little concerned when there is not enough diversity of view on the show because there is other perspective, and the tagline says that, you know, it's a paranoia or hysteria in the African-American community. But, you know, the question that Dr. Gale raises when she says African-Americans are 9 times more likely to be affected than their counterparts, the question statistically is why would we be 9 times more likely to be affected than our white counterpart if there is nothing conspiratorial about it? I mean, what in our lifestyle makes us 9 times more susceptible to it? And I think that the African-American church or the black church is put on the spot, you know, because somehow I didn't see that when this problem began, they said the white church had to take on responsibility of educating the white community. And I know some white churches are involved, but the Catholic Church hasn't moved in, and the Presbyterian Church hasn't moved in. They have not set up real strong centers of education, but the aids have gone down in those communities. And it's funding, and the funding has not been consistently fair based on the demand. But the African-American Church did not take up the issue of drugs, and clearly that the root of AIDS in the African-American community has been more prominent through the HIV community than it's been through the homosexual community. And I don't think that we need to despair either one, but we got to ask the question, why are African-Americans so susceptible? Is this the same AIDS that affected African-Americans that affect Africans?
Lewis,
the problem of drugs and homosexuality?
Lewis, let's let Helene Gale answer that question.
Yeah, you raise a whole bunch of points, and I'll be as brief as I can to try to touch on most of them. When I said 9 times more likely to develop AIDS or die from AIDS, that does not reflect that African Americans are more susceptible to the virus. It means that the African American community, by and large, has less access to the things that can affect the disease. And so a large reason why cases of actual AIDS, not new infections with HIV, but AIDS, the disease, why cases have gone down in this country is because of the new and better treatments that are available. That's why deaths due to AIDS have gone down. It's not surprising that a community that has less good access to health care overall would have less good access to these drugs that make a difference in the rate of development of the actual disease as well as the rates of death due to the disease. So a lot of it can be explained because we don't have the same access to the information, we don't have the same access to the services. And that's, you know, and we know that across the board in health in general. So that's what we've got to work towards. We've got to get people aware of what's available. We need to get people tested so, in fact, they know they're infected and then can have access to these therapies. We know that overall there's about a third of people who are HIV infected who don't even know it. So we've got to get people tested, get them into services, and have equal access. As far as overall, why are our rates continuing to be higher? For a variety of reasons. Again, it's not a biological susceptibility. It's the fact that issues like other sexually transmitted diseases that make you more susceptible to HIV are higher in our community, the impact of drug use, as well as the fact that men who have sex with men, who across the board are the greatest risk for this disease, in communities of color, African-American communities, don't necessarily have the same supports that the white gay community had. They don't have the same educational services. And oftentimes there's a lot of African-American men who have sex with other men who are closeted, who don't admit that they're having same-sex relationships, and so are not going to be as open to receiving information about, quote, gay men. So there are a whole range of issues, and others can touch on some of those as well.
Dr. Helene Gale, who's with the National Center for HIV, STD, and TB Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. Gary Daffin, you're right there where the rubber meets the road. What's your experience? Anything to add to what Helene Gale just told us?
Well, I think both within some of what the questioner was saying and in Helene's response, that one enormous issue is stigma. And if you listen closely, some of what I heard in the question was the assertion that homosexuality and drug use are not playing the same role in communities of color as they do in other communities is just not correct. Because if you look at who's getting infected, I mean, people are getting infected through injection drug use, both men and women, or through men having sex with men, or being the partners of those two groups of people. So I think there's a dynamic that happens within the community that marginalizes men who have sex with men, whether they identify as gay or not, and injection drug users. And so the community tends not to want to deal with those populations. And so we're not embracing them.
Reverend Sharpen, is that your experience? Reverend Al Sharpen, is that your experience, that the community just doesn't want to deal with this problem?
Well, I think
with that particular sector of the community?
I think that there has been the problem of stigma, as he said, but I think that that is part of the challenge that we must face, and that is to not deal with perceptions that are false or real, and not deal with the whole marginalizing of people. This is a serious problem. And when I say that we need to deal with not just conspiracy theories, I'm not to minimize at all that we need to get to why we are 9 times more susceptible. But I'm saying that we should not do that at the expense of servicing and researching how we deal with the people that are suffering and the people that need this information. But clearly, we need to get to the root causes of why there's a disproportionate impact in our community. But what I'm saying is that our priority ought to also make sure that we service people and make sure that we provide what they need.
Let's 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Please join our discussion on the connection. We're talking about AIDS in the African-American community. The Reverend Irene Monroe is on the line from Cambridge. Welcome to the show, Reverend.
Thank you. One who's been working in the community in New York and then came here to Harvard and began working in the black community around AIDS, one of the things that I have begun to really think seriously about is that we really need to decentralize the black church's role in this epidemic. One is that it pretty much has had a laissez-faire attitude from its inception, and we're sort of waiting for them to sort of pick up the baton and run with it. And in that waiting period, I think a lot more of us will continue to suffer. One of the things that I think the reason why we suffer in terms of, I like what Gary Daffin was saying, is that there is a stigma about having AIDS in our community. And part of that has to do with the way in which we have constructed a black identity. We have set up what I call sort of a hierarchy of oppression. We believe that being black is the only type of oppression that we ought to address and face in our community so we don't address issues like sexism and homophobia. You're not likely to get this exiled population of people to now come to the black church and seek help, because we don't want to be embraced under this sort of theological qualifier, love the sinner but hate the sin. So at this point, I think one strategy is not to look to the black church so heavily as to look to government and other types of agencies that will very much distribute the information and the health services that we need to really address this issue.
Belinda Dunn, you're sitting there from the black church, and do you think that people are beginning to rely too much, or hoping that the black church will sort of pick up the baton and carry it forward here?
I really don't think that I'm speaking from a point of view of a person that's living with HIV and a person that can't take the AIDS cocktail, that because I have hepatitis C, therefore I have no means of through medication to take care of myself. When I go to church is the only time that I feel alive, that I feel warm. And I think a lot of people depend on that spiritual connection to make them survive from day to day. The church is our oldest and largest institution. I have been in the church all of my life. And
what about that, Reverend Monroe? Isn't that?
I hear that, and you know, and Belinda, hi there.
Hi.
It's like, but she's one of the fortunate ones. She's one of the ones that have the kind of spiritual tenacity to, like, in spite of how the Black Church has framed its theology about us lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, she can still walk and sit, you know, walk with these people and pray with these people. But there's so many of us on any given Sunday who are not even HIV positive, who cannot comfortably walk in our churches openly. I mean, clearly the church needs us, because I will always argue that the preaching ministry is as integral to Black worship as the music ministry. And many of us lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people have that role in the Black church, but it's closeted. But Belinda is one of a small group, you know, and she's lucky. And I mean, she's found a haven, but so many that I know of my friends who are HIV, you know, positive, don't have that option.
Could I just, I'm going
to... Good, I was going to ask you, Dr. Gale, to come into the conversation.
Okay.
You have to be really brief, though.
This is my last comment. I've got to sign off. I guess I would just go back to saying it is not an either-or. I think the Black Church has a critical role to play in this epidemic, because it has such a critical, critical role in the lives of Black people overall. So we can't forget the Black Church, and I hope that as a result of being involved in this, the Black Church, as all churches, may move in their position on some of these issues too. So I think there's some mutual benefit, if you will. On the other hand, I think government has a responsibility, private sector has a responsibility, civic organizations. So I think it is not an either or, it is a plus plus.
Dr. Helene Gale, thank you for being with us from the CDC. And we want to thank Al Sharpton, Reverend Al Sharpton, who is with us from New York. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio, 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection, a look back at the history of the jazz piano. Air.com.
I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about AIDS and the African-American community. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK is the number to join our discussion with Belinda Dunn of the Who Touched Me Ministry and Gary Daffin of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition. I'd like to take a call right now from Bill. Bill, welcome to The Connection.
Hi, John. How are you?
Fine so far.
Okay, John, I just finished the book Monday called Emerging Viruses by Len Horowitz, and his thesis is that the AIDS virus was introduced to the homosexual community in New York City and Ugandan blacks in around the mid-70s through hepatitis B vaccines. May have been deliberate, may have been accidental, but that's the cause. And he does more or less lean towards the idea it was introduced deliberately. And I can just recommend the book, Emerging Viruses, Len Horowitz. He has a degree from the Harvard School of Public Health. It's certainly not a wacko fringe book. It's quite brilliant as far as I'm concerned.
What on earth would be the reason for introducing this deliberately?
Well,
does it give a reason?
Yes, it was a biochemical warfare. Genocidal. I mean, I don't want to use these words but it was genocidal. In other words, it was directed at blacks and starting in Uganda. I guess there's no better way to say it. So the black community has to look to, if they're looking for causes, they have to look to...
Gary Daffin, is this one of those...
Pardon me?
I'm going to ask Gary Daffin to address your statement or question about this. Is this one of those myths that's very harmful to trying to deal with the situation out there?
It's harmful because it takes away attention from what needs to happen, which is people need to deal with the fact that HIV exists and people need to get tested and get into treatment. I don't think we really it's a nice intellectual exercise to go to study where HIV originated, but it's really not that relevant to our day-to-day work of getting people into healthcare and getting them treatment so that they don't die from this disease. Now, and I think a lot of these ideas are sort of wacko, I hate to say, and inconsistent. I mean, either they were biological warfare against blacks in New York or in Uganda, and the link between gays and blacks in New York and Uganda, I mean, it all gets to be a little bit silly after a while. So I think...
And some people are still getting sick.
And people are still getting sick. I mean, there are tens of millions of people in the world who are infected with HIV, and frankly, not many of them care how it originated. They care about how they can get better and how we can do something about helping them.
You don't think people care about how they contracted the disease?
Well, how they contracted the disease, they either contracted it through unprotected sex or through injection drug use or, in developing countries, children from their mothers in utero. That's how people get disease, get HIV.
Bill, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's take one more call from Wairimu on the line. I hope I got your name correct. Welcome to the show.
I just have a comment about what was raised by a gentleman before in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Nine times more African American are infected with HIV/AIDS. And when Dr. Gill was answering that question, she didn't talk about the socioeconomic factor that play into a lot of African Americans getting infected with HIV/AIDS. And especially now that we know a lot of women, young African American women in the childbearing age, are the ones who are getting infected, and they're not homosexual and they're not drug users.
Gary, you were nodding your head in agreement.
Well, I agree with the first part and a little disagreement with the second part of what she said. There are root causes of why people get infected, and it's because if you look at gay black men, for example, I mean, the study done in New York, gay black men, there was no difference in behavior and there was no difference in knowledge about HIV and transmission. And in fact, there's some evidence that the young gay black men knew more about HIV than their white counterparts, and yet still there are 30% of them are infected. So there's something else going on, which is there's something that's preventing people from taking care of themselves. And so there's a lot, and it includes things like poverty and the lack of self-worth and its lack of self-esteem because of their position in the community.
Macho bravado? What is this?
No, I think it's a matter of people taking risks because they don't feel that they're worth. It's worth saving their own lives. That's what I think is at the core here. Now, the second thing she said about, there is, when we talk about resources, people tend to talk about resources to deal with women and children in African American communities, and people focus on the fact that more women are getting infected, and they are, and that's a real problem. But we also need to know how they're getting infected, and those women are getting infected at being partners, but also from their own injection drug use. And overall, in the epidemic, we have roughly a third gay men, I mean, men who are having sex with men in communities of color, that's how they're getting infected. A third injection drug use, that's how they're getting infected. And then the others are partners of those folks or other ways, or they're from other countries or whatever. So, you know, we need to not hide the fact that the people in communities of color who are getting infected, many of them are gay men who are identified as gay, or men who are having sex with men who are not identified, people who are injecting drugs, both men and women, and the people who are having sex with those people in those categories who don't know that they're at risk. So, I mean, I think we have to be, one of the things we have to do about to eradicate the stigma is to talk about how this disease is affecting the community, who's getting infected, and how we need to work to make sure that those people who are also a part of our community protect themselves or get into care.
Melinda Dunn, the issue of black womanhood. We've been talking about young black gay men, but what about the infection rates in black women and your own situation?
This is something very personal. I'm certainly happy that we are finally arriving in this place because in the beginning of when I was infected and tested in 1990, there were no services for women. There was no one there to give you information of any kind. And after speaking with many, many women who were infected the same way I was, that had a partner that was injecting drugs and didn't tell me, died, and I would, if I hadn't gotten tested, I wouldn't have known of my HIV status. Men, women who have men that have been in jail that don't consider themselves as being gay would come out of jail, get infected in jail, and come out and infect them. You know, you have young girls, especially when welfare reform came around and just wiped out their whole, you know, means of support, were depending on older men to support them. And naturally, they're not going to ask them to use a condom. They're not going to put any demands on him. He is the breadwinner. So there's issues that we have to dig a little bit deeper to account for the cases among women. But I think one of the biggest issues is non-information. Not having information on how to protect themselves.
Well, let's address that issue. Let's go out to San Francisco. Les Pappas is on the line from San Francisco. Les is the president of the Better World Advertising, which develops HIV prevention campaigns around the country. Welcome to the convention, Les.
Good morning.
Tell us, in your campaigns, how do you decide how to represent AIDS, the face of AIDS? Is there a particular need for minority role models? Do you have some special programs tailored for the minority community?
Well, we're working on a particular campaign in Boston that's called HIV Stops With Me, and it's kind of a new emphasis where we're trying to get people who are already infected involved in prevention. We're trying to, you know, encourage them to be leaders and role models in prevention. And that campaign is based around individuals who are HIV positive talking about their experience and talking about what they do to, you know, prevent the disease and make sure that no one else gets infected as you know, as a result of interaction with them. And so that campaign, we took real people and made a very, very personal, a varied group of individuals, and of course includes African American men. This particular campaign is aimed at gay and bisexual men. And I should just plug that people can go to the website, HIVstopswithme.org, and get more information about that. We've also done some work in New York where we were aiming our campaign specifically at young African-American men who don't identify as gay. And, of course, in that campaign, we pictured a couple of young African-American men. I mean, from a marketing point of view, of course, you really do want to use people and imagery and languages that the group that you're targeting can relate to. But I wanted to make one comment about resources, because I know that's been mentioned during the hour. And, you know, companies like McDonald's and Nike spend literally billions of dollars every year trying to get African Americans and others to you know, to buy their hamburgers and buy their shoes. I mean, if we had that kind of money in terms of prevention, I think we could do a much better job. And I think that does need to be acknowledged, that the program I mentioned that we did in New York a couple of years ago was a very small program. And, you know, we could have used 10 times or 100 times those resources if we were really committed as a society to preventing the disease.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Jack is on the line. Jack, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you. Good morning. I just wanted to reach out to some of those people that Dr. Irene Moore seemed to be speaking about, who felt there was no place for them on Sunday morning. There are some black churches in the greater Boston area that have made a specific effort to reach out to our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. I'm a member of one of those congregations, Union United Methodist Church. We officially, by vote of the congregation, became a reconciling congregation to accept all people into our church. We had a celebration with the bishop, and on Sunday morning, I want those brothers and sisters, white or black, to know that there is a place they can walk into church, be lifted by the Spirit. We're at corner of West Newton and Columbus in the south end of Boston. And I just want to make sure that message gets out, that there are black churches that are trying to work through this, and with the help of God, we'll come through it.
Thanks very much for your call. Belinda, you look like you want to say something.
Oh, well, I have to say that Union Methodist did one of the Week of Prayers services the other night, and it was really wonderful. And I'm working with 36 churches that in Dorchester, Mattapan, Roxbury, that will accept anybody that walks in the door. So I do think that we need to give the churches some credit, the ones that are out there and sticking themselves out there and really trying to embrace this disease and the people,
disease. I think what we need here is a mutual respect agreement, which is, it's great that there are churches who are going to be open and embracing of gay and lesbian people, but a lot of them are not. And I don't think it's a binary proposition. It's not as if you've got to take everybody and get up and say that they're wonderful or we're just going to go protest.
Right.
We got to meet people where they are. Right. And there's sort of a dual respect needed here. I mean, on the one hand, I'm an openly gay man. I've been gay since I was 10, and I have no problem working with ministers. I respect them, and they respect where I'm coming from. And we don't try to sort of force the other to accept something. And yet, so we come to a common ground and figure out what's the real goal here. And the real goal is to get information out to people in the churches and to create a way or path for people to get tested and to get counseling and to get into healthcare. And that means working with the providers and the churches. We may not be able to go into the churches and start talking about condoms, but we can go in and start talking about, you have a moral responsibility to take care of yourself and your family, so get tested and get into care. So we tend to end up in these fights about you're going to accept me for all that I am or nothing, and I'm going to either submit to the church and say that any sex outside of marriage, and I can't get married, so what am I supposed to do, is good, is bad. So we got to sort of ease up a bit and sort of figure out how to respect each other and get to the goal.
Thank you, Gary Daffin. Gary heads the Multicultural AIDS Coalition, and thanks to Belinda Dunn. She directs the Who Touch Me ministry here in Boston. Thanks to Les Pappas out in San Francisco. His company, Better World Advertising, develops HIV prevention campaigns around the country. Earlier in the hour, we talked to Dr. Helene Gale. She directs the National Center for HIV, STD, and TB Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control. And we talked with the Reverend Al Sharpton, president of the National Action Network in New York City. The music we heard this hour was recorded during our visit to the United Lenten and AIDS Prayer Service at the Roxbury Presbyterian Church in Boston. I'm John McChesney. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation. This is WBUR.